You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Forrest Gander. Forrest, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thanks, Brainerd. I'm happy to be here.
Forrest, what are you working on now? I know you're going to read a little bit today, and we're going to talk about your work, but what are you working on at the moment?
So I've just handed a manuscript into my editors at New Directions of a book that's curiously mostly about lichen and thinking about lichen, which we mostly learned in high school is a collaboration between a fungus and a cyanobacteria or an algae, and they get together, we learned, and become something synergistic. But it turns out it's way more complicated than that. And when those organisms join up, they lose the properties that they originally had to become something different. And according to one of the primary mycologists in the country, Anne Pringle, she thinks that maybe lichen doesn't age, and that it may be something that makes us reconsider death, which as mammals we've always considered in sort of mammalian terms. And so thinking about two things that get together that maybe don't die and that are changed forever, lichen becomes for me a metaphor for intimacy.
That's fascinating. And so, I mean, on a number of levels, the book sounds like a fascinating topic. And I'd love to hear more about that, but also the idea that lichen doesn't die or has some insights, you know, biologically into the mechanisms of aging, it sounds like, or death itself. That's quite extraordinary.
It is extraordinary, and Pringle's work on this is very interesting. It's not that lichen can't die, you can kill it, but given enough light and moisture, it may not age. It may continue to grow and grow and grow forever.
And is that so different than, let's say, a tree that can last hundreds of years? Potentially, maybe a tree could last longer.
They do last longer. Yeah.
Right.
Out here in California, I've been working with an Irish artist named Katie Holton on redwood trees, and we've been looking at stands of redwood trees that are 2,000 to sometimes 3,000 years old. They can live a really long time, but they die, and lichen may not.
That's just fascinating. This has been obviously a big year for you. I want to hear about I want you to read, but you got the 2019 Pulitzer Prize in Poetry, and of course are, in many ways a decorated poet. You've won a lot of awards. Is this year a particularly special year for you because of the Pulitzer, or do you not have a relationship to the way I would? I mean, I'm of course kind of wowed that seems it's hard for artists, which I interview regularly, to get any kind of accolades in this world, but poets even harder, I would think, than visual artists. So just reflecting, I guess, on this year for you, is it a particularly great year in terms of the support you've gotten and the Pulitzer and everything else?
Yeah, I like how you work for artists and for helping artists to get a little more acclaim for themselves. And I like how you're also involved in collaboration, which has been really important to me as an artist. And of course, yeah, this was an unusual year. I'm not going to get another Pulitzer, I don't imagine. And I've been a working poet for most of my life. Showed up in my freshman college professor's little house at William & Mary, and he told me that my poems were terrible. And I began to take myself more seriously to figure out what was going wrong. So it was a it was a big year,
That's such an interesting anecdote. And if I can ask, what was going wrong?
Well, I wasn't reading enough contemporary poetry. I was reading. My mom read me early 20th century poetry, and my grandfather used to stomp around the house reciting 19th century poetry, but I wasn't reading my contemporaries enough. And so I was rehearsing things that had already been done.
Well, I'd love to hear one of your works. I know you're going to read a few things, and so I'd love to hear the first one if you could introduce it. And I'm glad you answered that question, because it's that does seem to be so important, of course, to and a simple answer, but such a profound one in a way to read the work of your contemporaries, right? This is what gives us a sense of not just language, but what is what's ultimately published and put out into the world, and I guess a sense of why as well, right?
Yeah, that thing Rimbaud says about energy constantly flows into new forms. Well, you need to be looking for the new forms. You can still write a sonnet, but you can't write the same sonnet that Shakespeare wrote the same way and have it resound in your own time. You have to make some changes. So here's a poem that's from the new manuscript that'll be coming out from New Directions. And so it's this lichen-connected work. But this is based also on Sangam literature, which is a literature that was a kind of renaissance in southern India between 300 BC and 300 AD. And in it, the poets were dealing with a lot of the same concerns that ecological poets are interested in today. And in Sangam literature, in the poetry, the human emotion is connected directly to a particular landscape and sort of is at one with the landscape. So here's my variation on that, called Immigrant Sea. Aroused by her inaccessibility, he aches for more of her life to live inside him, watching the breakers, standing so close he can feel heat coming off her wet scalp. What is his relation to this person before him, so familiar and foreign? The way he searches out her face, he searches out himself. Gusts thrash crests of swell, spring grasses twirl circles in the sand, where they stand without speaking. She wants him to know it's all charged, even grass positive, pollen negative. So when grass waves, it sweeps the air for pollen. He feels electricity all around, as though the wild drama of the coming storm were already aware of them, foreigners on this shore. Little sapphire blue flowers speckle the dunes. He wonders if he has let himself flatten out into a depthless sheet like escalator stairs, whether in the end he'll disappear underground without the smallest lurch of resistance. But when her lavish face turns toward him, beaming, the corners of her eyes wind wet, he yields to that excess. He reappears to himself.
Thank you. I love that. There's so many beautiful images in there. And while I was trying to understand, initially in your description of how talking about lichen can be intimate, and in this case, even kind of romantic and very sexy. I had no idea how that would happen, but it's really lovely. You know, the sound of it is beautiful, and it sounds erotic. You know, it's more than the, I mean, intimacy is one word, but it sounds like an erotic relationship. Am I reaching with that?
No, I'm interested in writing about the erotic, especially in a time when Eros is so threatened by the bluntness of politics and pornography and hatred and fear. I think it's there's something very healthy in the erotic that's difficult to write about and worthwhile.
I think so too. And so this book, this is a book that just came out, or this is a manuscript that was just submitted?
This is a manuscript that was just submitted and accepted by the New Directions. It'll be out either next year or at the very beginning of 2021.
That's exciting. And I want to hear another one, but just to ask you a little more about how you got onto this whole subject, because now I can see that's fascinating. And though I know so little about the world of lichen, I'm learning about it through that poem, as well as just, you know, hearing something beautiful. So how was it that you initially got involved? Was it through that one book, or this, how did you initially get involved with this idea of lichen as the basis of a, or part of it as the basis of a narrative and then a book?
Yeah, well, my name is Forrest, and so I've sort of been grown up, you know, in near the woods, and I've spent a lot of time there as a kid and since. And like a lot of poets now, I'm very obsessed with the ecological crisis that we live in now, which is one of the interesting things. I think it'll interest you too, Brandon, because when we think of art movements or literary movements, almost all of them are started by, you know, a group of men, a small group of men in some capital city, usually Paris. But this sort of movement that's come to be called eco-poetics, which is sort of thinking about writing a more sort of ethical nature poem, and a poem that enacts a kind of different kind of ethical relationship between human and nature, where the things are part of each other, as of course we are nature, instead of something that we look at and dominate or just describe. And this movement, eco-poetics, unlike any other literary or art movement that I can think of, has sort of flourished all at once, all over the world. And again, among its early major practitioners were lots of women, which makes it really different. Inger Christensen, for instance, in Denmark, Coral Bracho in Mexico, Julia Fedorczyk in Poland. I consider myself part of that group of people interested in thinking about our ecological predicament and thinking about writing towards it responsibly, but in as art, not as essay or polemic.
So as art, but this whole movement also sounds a bit, it's conscious. It's certainly what's needed and what's called for. But would you call it also activist? It's about making a difference in the world, right? Which seems, art can do that, of course, and be transformative. But is that the idea of the movement to kind of activist gear to it?
Well, in the same way that when you're thinking about making a painting or doing a collaborative performance, with your wife, for instance, that you're thinking about altering people's perceptions because we fall into ruts of perception, and that's what art can do, is to get us out of those ruts so that we see things differently. And so, in a sense, yeah, I think of that as a kind of exigency, as a kind of way of promoting a different way of looking at the world. But I think that's always what good art has done. Don't you?
Yes, yes, I do too. I agree. I think that is, what a lot of good work does. So let's hear another one. I know you have a few more for us to hear. What is the next poem you're going to read?
So here's a poem called Forest with One R, which is from that same sort of Sangam series. Forest. Erogenous zones in oaks, slung with stoles of lace lichen, the sun's rays spilling through leaves in broken packets, a fourth, call it nighttime, thrusts mushrooms up from their lair of spawn, mycelial loam, the whiff of port. They pop into untrammeled air with the sort of gasp that follows a fine chess move. Like memories, are they, or punctuation? Was it something the earth said to provoke our response, tasking us to recall an evolutionary course, our long-ago initiation into the one among others? And within my newborn noticing, have you popped up beside me, love? Or were you here from the start, a swarm of meaning and decay still gripping the underworld? Both of us half-buried, holding fast, if briefly, to a swelling vastness, while our coupling begins to register in the already awake compendium that offers to take us in, you take me in, and abundance floods us, floats us out. We fill each with the other all morning, breaks as birdsong over us, who rise to the surface that our faces might be sprung.
Thank you. I love that. That's a wonderful piece. Is there a poem? Is there something you want to say about it? I'm not sure what to jump in and say to that right away, except that it makes me smile. You know, it's a great feeling to that piece.
Good. Thanks. You know, also sort of merging the human state the mycelial state, which is also a kind of intimacy and collaboration, and thinking of works like Richard Powers' The Overstory, or my late wife C.D. Wright's important book called Casting Deep Shade, which is a pan to beech trees. And thinking also in a time of such bad news of finding ways to write about something hopeful, something positive.
Yeah, that is it's such a fascinating kind of problem, right? How to do that in all of these interviews that have taken place, of course, over the, you know, and through the presidency of a current presidency, it's a struggle that everyone's dealing with, and in one way or another, you know, how do you say something hopeful in this time? And I think that's an important and an essential role for artists and writers.
Yeah, I look for models, people who can do that. Robert McFarlane and Richard Powers, C.D. Wright, Brenda Hillman, someone else who's writing in a way that is both political and fierce, but has joy in it. Joan Retallick, a wonderful writer, says, "Don't forget the fun in profundity."
I like that. That's a wonderful, wonderful quote. So you have one more for us. I'd love to hear before you go. What is the next one that you're reading?
Okay, I think I'll read one poem from Beworth, which was the book that won the Pulitzer. And you can see from this poem, I mean, Beworth was me in just the bottommost abyss, which is why I'm trying to write differently. I could not stay there in that abyss after my wife's death. This is a poem called Beckoned. At which point, my grief sounds ricocheted outside of language, something like a drifting swarm of bees. At which point, in the tetric silence that followed, I was swarmed by those bees and lost consciousness. At which point, there was no way out for me either. At which point, I carried on in a semi-coma, dreaming I was awake, avoiding friends and puking, plucking stingers from my face and arms. At which point, her voice was pinned to a backdrop of vaporous color. At which point, the crane's bustles flared. At which point, coming to, I knew I'd pay the whole flagpole fare. At which point, the driver turned and said, "It doesn't need to be your fault for it to break you." At which point, without any lurching commencement, he began to play a vulture bone flute. At which point, I grew old, and it was like ripping open the beehive with my hands again. At which point, I conceived a realm more real than life. At which point, there was at least some possibility in which I didn't believe. And the reading there.
Thank you. Very. It's, of course, it's enormously powerful and upsetting. And when we started this this interview, you were saying that initially I thought you were going to read that one first, but you were also saying that that's been a book that you don't read from much anymore because it's so difficult.
All of us, of course, lose people who are dear from us to us, and all of us will be lost to people who hold us dear. But it's not a natural thing when you say you spend, 30 years with someone, and your identity becomes so collaborative. It becomes so mutual. It becomes like that mycelium under the trees. And when one person is ripped away, all of the memories that you've had for 30 years are, their substance is they're being collaborative. They're being something that's shared, and they seem to lose their substance in the absence of the other person. I didn't write after my wife's death for a year and a half, and then these poems came out. Just as a way of I don't know how they came out like vomit, really. I didn't feel like I had anything I wanted to express.
And since they've been out, I imagine had all different kinds of receptions and feedback from different books. That one in particular, that series of poems. Was there a lot of feedback or? About that, because it's such a difficult thing to exchange, to talk about for all of us. Yeah, I'm wondering how that was received.
So thanks for asking that, Raynard, because that is the surprising thing for me. I don't want to theatricalize a grief. I don't want it to be just about me, and yet it was my experience, and so I wrote it. But the way people have responded has been by writing me about their own grief and about how the articulation of mine helped them with theirs. And so it no longer became about me or about this fantastic poet, one of the best. I'm not singular in thinking she was the best poet of our generation, C.D. Wright. It became about other people's feelings, and that felt really rewarding to me, as it must for you when people tell you that something that you've done, this performance, opened up something in them and made something, made some feeling possible for them where they felt locked before.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you for reading that and the others. And I want to ask you one more question, which is, what are you reading at the moment?
Well, I'm reading a lot of translations right now because I'm judging the Penn Translation Prize. And I'm interviewing Richard Powers at Point Reyes Books in just a few weeks. And so rereading Richard Powers' The Overstory, feeling a little daunted. And then I'm traveling to Korea tomorrow for a literary festival, and I've been reading a lot of Korean poets, particularly women, and women influenced by Kim Hae-soon, a really important and fierce feminist figure in Korean poetry right now.
Well, thank you so much for your time today and your reading. I'm grateful. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Raynard. It's been a real pleasure to find out who you were a little bit and to get to speak with you. Thanks.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.